This is the Marketing Podcast Network.
Welcome to Uncorking a Story, the podcast that introduces you to the rich world of storytellers who share their personal journeys, creative processes, and the stories behind their stories, one conversation at a time. I'm your host, Mike Carlin, and I'm thrilled to be part of your writing journey. If you're an aspiring writer, a literary enthusiast, or simply someone who believes in the transformative power of words, you've come to the right place. Every week, we'll pop the cork on the world of successful storytellers and give you a healthy pour of inspiration, insight, and empowerment. My mission is to help writers like you realize your full potential through the transformative and therapeutic power of writing. Whether you're just starting your literary voyage or looking to refine your craft, I'm here to provide you with the knowledge, inspiration, and encouragement you need to embark on your own storytelling adventure. So, are you ready to uncork your story and let your creativity flow? Uncorking a Story is about to begin. Sit back, relax, and let the transformative magic of storytelling whisk you away. Welcome to Uncorking a Story. Today on Uncorking a Story, I'm pleased to introduce you to international award-winning fine art photographer Gary Smith. He joins me today on Uncorking a Story to discuss his career and book Pathways, which was awarded first prize at the prestigious International Photography Awards in the book category. Pathways features select photos from many of Smith's current collections, including several of his recent multi-award winning images. Welcome to Uncorking a Story, Gary.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
Happy to have you here, Gary. And tell me, where does your story as an author begin?
So, first of all, it was a long time ago. Let's start with that. But it was in the industrial part of England. I grew up in the industrial sort of heartland of England in the Midlands, you know, where the sort of the last industrial revolution came. And that's where my interest in photography, you know, started. And I think has been, you know, molded from there. I picked up my first camera when I was, you know, barely a teenager, an old plate camera, and I was just infatuated ever since.
Yeah, what do you suppose it was about photography that drew you in?
You know, first of all, I couldn't paint, I couldn't draw, you know, there was no other sort of talents. I remember my older brother was just fantastic at that stuff, and I was always, you know, sort of envious of him, and I was really terrible. So I think some of it was just a way subconsciously of just expressing, you know, I could actually create this photograph and I could manage it, and it didn't require any of the, you know, the artistic skills on the, from a hand eye, you know, that kind of perspective. So I suspect there's, you know, there's a fair amount to that.
Yeah. And it sounds like you always knew that there was like a creative type living inside you.
Yeah, I always, you know, I was super interested, even as a young kid. I used to read a lot, and the visual arts, you know, and music, and just all of that. And I had no particular talent to it, but photography, really, I sort of honed in on that because it was this combination of you could control the whole kind of process and produce something. And I was absolutely, you know, dark rooms, and you know, I got into all of that, and eventually that was my first sort of career, was in, you know, big industrial plate cameras, black and white typically. So I had a sort of a technical apprenticeship, I guess you'd call it that, in I was the assistant to the assistant who made the coffee, you know, and that's how I learned my trade, in a very, you know, what is now a very, you know, film-orientated, old-fashioned kind of photographic sort of process, which I think sort of helps me now, because, you know, you get that kind of technical training on the basics, and I worked in a dark room and all of that stuff. The great thing about that is it's a very slow process. And so, you know, even today, I apply a lot of the learnings and approaches to what I do now, to kind of slow down the, in the digital age, of course, where everything's, you know, so instant. You know, I'm kind of the opposite of that, for good or for worse.
Yeah, you know, I think about my kids and their generation. So I have three 22-year-olds. So we're the parents of triplets. And, you know, they take photos all day long. And, of course, it's on their phone. And I keep telling them, like, you guys will never know what it's like to actually, you know, use a roll of film. First of all, load a roll of film into a camera and then use it up. And yeah, you get 24 or maybe 36 exposures. So you got to be really selective about what you're going to be, you know, using each snap for, and then bringing it somewhere to have it, you know, processed and then waiting a week or so to pick it up. It's so instantaneous. Now, of course, you're working in dark rooms and stuff like that, which, by the way, I always thought dark rooms were like, was involved wizardry, because to me, it sounded so cool to, like, I don't know, you have your film strips and your chemicals and your papers and you have to have the red light. You can't have somebody open the door, because I've seen enough movies. But to me, it's like, I need you to demystify that whole process, because to me, it's like sorcery. It's like something out of Harry Potter.
Well, it's this combination of, you know, there's a lot of sort of chemistry to it, basically. I mean, you know, find a point on it. And, you know, but there's still a fair amount of, you take someone like Ansel Adams, who is, by the way, he did a lot of what they call post-processing. So meaning, you know, listen, he's an unbelievable photographer that got captured in the film. But he did a lot of handwork, literally, you know, with the projector to emphasize certain areas, dark and light, and, you know. So there's a, you know, there's an art piece to it, and there's a science piece to it. I always struggled with the science piece to it, personally, you know, all the chemistry and the rest of it. And I'm sure it was never particularly good for you. You know, you're in this small room with all these sort of fairly toxic type chemicals, and you got to, you know, put them in sequence in the right kind of timing. Otherwise, it, you know, your image won't work. So there's this great combination of focus, where you're looking at one image that you're literally, you know, printing through a projector onto a piece of paper. And it really focuses the mind on the image, because you've got kind of one shot at it, and you've got to, you know, make sure you get that right. Then you've got the, you know, the processing part, sticking it in the chemicals, and then the drying of it, and the, you know, the water of it, and the rest of it. So it's quite an involved process, but it makes, to your point about film work, it makes you focus on the image, because you're spending so much time on just one image, you know, and there's something cathartic about that, frankly. And the whole environment of the dark room, I actually miss, frankly, you know, because it was very, you know, therapeutic in many ways. You know, you're just lost in your own thoughts and imagery. And now, of course, you know, it's instant on your phone, and you know, we don't get, I think, the degree of focus and intensity on the image, because you can produce them so quickly.
Right.
But
right, I imagine it's like almost meditative time for you, you know, some of those times in the dark room.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it really was. And, you know, I didn't realize it at the time. I was a young, you know, sort of teenager and early 20s. But I look back on it now, and they were very meditative times. They really were, where you could sort of get out from the rest of the world and get some peace and quiet and focus on trying to create something. And, you know, very often it wouldn't come out quite as you wanted, and you'd maybe have to go back and, you know, do it again. And but you couldn't afford to take too many images. Just the cost on the big plate cameras at the time was super expensive. And when I did it for a living, obviously, you know, you had to move it along, and that created some, you know, pressure.
Yeah. So you talked to me about the difference between, you know, photography as a hobby and photography as a career for you. Did, you know, because oftentimes a lot of people will tell me, hey, don't make your hobby your career, because you'll lose something with it. Was that true at all for you, or no?
Yeah. Yes, you know, I think I'm a kind of poster child for that comment, frankly. You know, it's I absolutely adored photography, and I really thought that was going to be my career. But it's a very few amount of folks that can actually, certainly back in that time, unless you want to do wedding photography or do people, and I'm hopeless at people, so that was just never an option. So if you go down the sort of artsy commercial world to it, it's tough to earn a living, even an okay living. And so, I found that I really loved photography, but I didn't like the commercial demands of delivering on a timetable and the rest of it to stuff. It kind of selfishly interfered with what I wanted to go photograph and what I wanted to do, and I really struggled with the two things. And eventually, I moved into the tech world and into telecoms, and that's where I've been. But I've come back to photography. I always did it as a hobby in the background to it. But when when we empty nested, I got two older boys, had a little more time. And so, I re-engaged with it a little more seriously. And that's great, because I'm doing it selfishly for me, and I can take my time over what image is and what I want to do and how I want to manifest it. If you're relying on doing that and commercially selling it, that's a whole different tension, I think. That's very challenging, and I was certainly never capable of, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So no, I think I'm a poster child for don't make your hobby and in some ways I didn't pick up a camera for almost a decade, because I'd really kind of burned out from it a little bit on the whole commercial stuff.
Yeah, love what you have to say about finding the time as you're an empty nester. Because I'm going through that now in my life. I'm still, of course, working a day job, but I'm finding time now that I didn't have when my kids were younger. Now they're out of the house, they're about to graduate from university. And, I can devote more time to the things that I'm a little bit more passionate about. Of course, I also devote a lot of time to watching really old TV in the evenings, I joke with my wife. I'm like, I thought being an empty nester, we'd be going out all the time and, we'd be living, living it up a little bit more. But instead, we're in home at 10 o'clock, at night, every night, watching Kojak. And and then Quincy right afterwards. Like that's what empty has become for me.
Classic series. Yeah, it takes on, you think you have this view around what it might be, an empty nesting thing. And I think for a lot of people, it turns out very different. I didn't expect to dive into this quite as deep as I have done again, but it's a sort of rekindled passion, if you want to call it that, without the sort of commercial constraints of having to earn a living at it. So it's so much more fun. And by the way, learning all this digital stuff has been, super interesting and a big learning curve to me. But I also find that it helps me in my day job too, because it gives a bit of a balance to it. I'm in the sort of, high tech, spend most of my time, helping create the digital world and putting it all in the cloud and all of that stuff. And this is sort of the antithesis of that, both in terms of what I'm doing, a physical thing. And it's, much more cerebral. But, it provides a good balance. And I didn't really see that coming. I got to be honest, I didn't. But it provides a nice balance. I think I'm better in my day job because, I've got this interest elsewhere that's very, very different. And I come back to the day job sometimes, having gone off for a little bit into the photography piece. And, you come back refreshed, or you've been thinking about an issue in the background that you deal with. So it just, different part of the brain, I guess.
Yeah, it's a different part of the brain, but it's also like feeding your soul something that it needs too.
Yeah.
And, I find that, as well, like one of the hobbies I did pick up after, you know, after the empty nest thing, was doing improvisational comedy.
Wow.
And I find that, you know, learning how to actively listen to like your scene partner, to create something in the moment, on the spot, you know, has helped me in my day job too, which involves, I don't just interview people on a podcast for a living. I work in market research, so I get to interview people on a wide variety of topics, but it helps me become a better listener. And it gives me, you know, a little bit more energy because number one, I've got something else to look forward to. But it also like sharpens my skills in a way that I didn't necessarily anticipate either.
But don't you think some of that as well, Michael, is, you know, we think of, or typically my generation thought of careers as, you know, you'd be in finance or in lawyer or whatever it is, or marketing. And that's kind of what you would do, really to the exclusion of everything else, you know, on set. But in fact, I think most people get more fulfillment, and I'd argue they're generally more rounded and balanced if they have some other interests or they've done other things too. So, you know, when they come back to their marketing job or their, you know, finance, you know, you've got a core competence you have to have, you know, because that's how you get valued. But it's really the sort of EQ part of that that I think you really get, you know, more development of if you actually get out of your swim lane a little bit.
Yeah, no, I agree.
If that makes any sense.
Yeah, totally. Stretch out a little bit too. You know, I've been trying to think how I could use my skills to get out of marketing, you know, because I've been doing it for almost 30 years. And I think, geez, you know, I'd love to run a podcast for a living, but, you know, regardless of what you might think, there's not a lot of money in it.
Yep. Yeah.
Let's see, Joe Rogan or something like
that. Talking of improv and stand up. Listen, that's super brave. I mean, I'm really impressed with that. Anybody who can stand up and do that is that takes a lot of courage.
I think it takes a mix of courage and a fair amount of insanity. to be honest, I do think it does take a little bit of a weirdness too. Hey, that's just me.
Hey, we're all weird in our own ways, right?
Yeah, let the old freak flag fly.
Yeah.
I'm curious, Gary, tell me, how did Pathways come about, and what was your process for putting it together and all that?
Well, I was approached by, you know, a couple of publishers. Actually, one of the guys who actually produced Ansel Adams' his last book, and I collaborated with him, and unfortunately he passed when we got sort of about 6 months into planning the book and all the rest of it. And the creative director on that said, hey, let's finish this up, sort of as a collaboration. And she was saying, because I knew nothing about how to do a book, absolutely nothing. So she helped me navigate through it. A lady called Joanne Bolton, incredibly talented lady and very patient, by the way, you know, dealing with me. So we, you know, put together this book, and it was really, a sort of compilation of, you know, the work that I'd done in the last few years, and really reflects a sort of an approach that I have to it. You know, when I look at think about a scene or an image, you know, to me, there's always been sort of pathways through it. Where would the eye go? So if I, you know, as I look at it, what is my eye drawn to? What do I want to accentuate? What do I really see in that image? And then try and really focus in on that, sort of to the exclusion of other stuff, which is, you know, I use black and white. I use more minimalist imagery for that reason. So you sort of, how I think about it is sort of uncluttering of a scene to focus and present on the sort of essence that I think in the image. And, you know, that's sort of a bit of a necessity for me anyway, because I'm super colorblind. I mean, like, you know, very, very colorblind. So I don't see all the beautiful, vivid shades of color that, you know, everybody else sees. So I think what that does is it you know, I focus on the form a little bit more, and it makes, I think, for what I call a sort of slower perspective of things. So I identified a bunch of images, you know, working with Joanne, and we put that together for Pathways. And, you know, the two other sort of motivations to it were, number one, given my digital world, excuse me a second, I have my Labrador attacking me.
I've got a lab too. And yeah, I know exactly what you're going through at this moment.
He sneaked in the door here. All right, buddy.
He's like, Dad, I've got a ball. You know what we're supposed to do.
I got a ball. He hasn't played with me for a couple of hours now. Yeah, I mean, we get into it. But excuse me a second, Michael. Let me just put that. Otherwise, he'll play. Sorry. The two things was, first of all, you know, as I said earlier, I sort of spend time helping create this great cloud, this digital thing with a communication perspective, and I wanted to do something physical. This old thing called a book, you know, that you feel like you've actually done something, and you could touch it and feel it and look at it. So, you know, I felt that. And the second thing is, you know, I wanted to try and raise money for breast cancer. I mean, like way too many families, you know, our family was touched by breast cancer as well, and my wife. And so, you know, it was actually sort of a way of, and I didn't sort of think about it until we could sort of got going to it. But so we donate all the, you know, any proceeds to the breast cancer. So it's kind of like a, you know, a twofer from that point of view. So that's the sort of, was the background context to it. And it ended up being way more difficult and complicated than I ever would have thought. So anybody who's thinking about a book is and without Joanne, I would have absolutely no chance, none.
I want to go back to something you said. Well, a few things you said I want to go back to, but one of them was how, you know, you're taking clutter out of the scene so you could focus on the image. And it's not too dissimilar from what any author really has to do when they're writing. So, you know, you're doing it with imagery. Writers have to do it in words. And in any scene, any chapter, you know, if you're thinking about your writing the right way, you've got to really strip away anything that's unnecessary.
Yep.
And so that the reader can focus on what's most important. And an editor will help you do that. But in some way, I'm just trying to draw a parallel between what you know, you're doing, putting together this collection of images, and what any author has to do when they're working on a book.
That's an interesting parallel. I've never thought about it like that, from the sort of written word to the actual image. Because I sort of, you know, when I'm actually looking in the, I kind of self-edit around, you know, what's interesting, what am I not interested in, what's got to, you know, how do we get this, the focal point of what I see in that image across, with, and get the rest of the stuff, you know, play secondary roles in it and take a sort of a pathway, you know, from an image point of view to get there. So, you know, yeah, there's some parallels to that, I think, in terms of, you know, when you write something, you want to get rid of all the, you know, the other stuff to be precise in the essence of what you want to say. That I think that's, you know, pretty analogous to what I think about in an image.
Yeah, and there's a temptation, and I know many of us, especially when you're younger as a writer or an author, and what I mean younger, not necessarily age-wise, but like, you know, earlier in your tenure, in your, yeah, as you're honing your craft, is to not want to kill your darlings so much. You know, you want to keep everything in because, of course, everything is so important, but then over time, you really learn that less is more.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is, and it's that's a bit therapeutic too. You know, that process of sort of sifting through stuff and looking at, you know, what is really, you think, important and what is not. I mean, because we're surrounded by so much noise nowadays, you know, and all the media, social media, and the rest of it. It's sort of, you know, decluttering, I think, has taken on a greater importance in many ways than it did before, because we're bombarded with stuff. And if you look at it from an image, you know, pure photography point of view, you know, listen, there's this thing about the iPhone has democratized photography and everybody's doing it. And Alison, I think that's great. That's fantastic. But you know, there's a tendency there to be very, you know, bright, shiny colors. If you look at what gets the most likes on, you know, Instagram, whatever, it's the oversaturated colors and the rest of it. And so I think there's a sort of a definitely a place, you know, I personally feel to declutter and chill out and just try and focus on the, you know, the beautiful focal point of the image, because I think we just miss so much in our daily lives when you're wandering around, you know, including sort of industrial scenes and the rest of it. I think there's beautiful architecture in that stuff, which I photograph, you know, and in derelict industrial areas. Sounds a little strange, but I, you know, I kind of grew up to it, so I'm sure I'm sort of drawn back to that sort of, you know, industrial structure and form, because I think there's some great structures in there that were designed, you know, in a beautiful way.
Yeah. Now, remind me, whereabouts? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Birmingham. In the, if you've seen Peaky Blinders, I don't know whether you've seen Peaky, but it's my hometown.
And isn't that where Black Sabbath came from? Did they come?
Yes, we had Led Zeppelin. Came from there. Robert Plant lived sort of around the corner. Yeah, it was great. There was a big music scene there. Yeah,
I mean, certainly something about that. I know Def Leppard was like from Sheffield, but certainly something about that sort of post-war industrial type thing that lends itself well, I think, to powerful imagery and powerful music as well.
Yeah, no, that's an interesting. I mean, a lot of the sort of, you know, the heavier rock stuff, certainly in the UK, came from the industrial, you know, industrial areas, not necessarily the South, you know, of London.
Yeah. Did you enjoy any of that music growing up or not?
Yeah, I did. My brother was a very talented musician and still is. And he played in a rock band and the rest of it. So he was a bit older than me. So he introduced me to like Led Zeppelin and Cream and Eric Clapton and all that stuff. So I kind of grew up with all of that. So very rich, you know, rock culture. So yeah, I still love it. I do.
Yeah.
Genesis, I guess, was just a little bit after that too. It was another one of my...
I love Genesis. I love their like progressive stuff in their earlier days with Peter Gabriel.
Yeah.
And then, you know, not to knock Phil Collins, I think he's a wonderful and talented musician and performer himself, but it was really a different sound from the Lamb Lies Down on Broadway, you know, jumping to Invisible Touch or something like that.
It was
that.
A different band. Yeah. They were the different, I mean, Phil Collins, very talented. He was a child actor before that. I think he was Oliver in the last big production of Oliver. You know, it was a movie. And but yeah, it's a very different band. And yeah, I'm you know, I'm old school, I'm afraid. I'm like for the Gabriel stuff as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
Still very old school.
Yeah. On that we can agree. You mentioned your wife with breast cancer and part of the proceeds going to this. How is your wife now?
She's good, thank you. No, she had it many years ago. She had it when she was, you know, in her early 40s. You know, as did a number of friends that we had at the time, ladies in their 40s. So, you know, makes you wonder around some environmental sort of elements to that. But no, we got it early and it was a full recovery and she had great care. But, you know, you want to, there seems to be certainly in certain parts of the US and on the East Coast, up from Richmond to Philadelphia, it's sort of, you know, an epidemic portions of breast cancer.
Yeah.
And so, you know, just helping to try and do a little bit to contribute to the, you know, the cure and to help people who've got it. You know, it sort of combines the interest in photography with, you know, trying to do some good.
Yeah, no, it's a wonderful thing. It's a wonderful thing. You know, I know people don't get rich off of books. You know, most people, unless your last name is Rowling or
that's,
something like that. So to donate proceeds to support a cause is wonderful, and certainly I'm certain there are a lot of people who are thanking you for that.
Well, you know, I always say a lot of that it's a selfish act because, you know, it makes you feel good. So, yeah. You know, it's a selfish, I think, all of that sort of any philanthropic stuff, we've got to do what we can, but it's a very selfish act in some way.
Fair enough. Yeah. Where can people pick up Pathways if they're so inclined?
It's on Amazon, both in Europe and in the US. So that's the easiest way to get it. There's two versions of it. There's a limited edition. There's 250 copies. There's still a few left. And then there's the normal edition as well. So they're both available on Amazon.
All right. And when people open it up, what can they expect to see?
A lot of black and white imagery, that's for sure. And an eclectic collection of stuff, too. So it's industrial pieces, some architectural, modern architectural stuff, which I love. You know, Frank Gehry and that kind of stuff, I'm a big fan. And then also, you know, which most people like is the classic landscape type stuff from around the world. You know, so I'm very fortunate, and I travel a lot. And have traveled a lot and lived in different parts of the world. So, you know, I've been able to get out to different locations. And so it's a whole gamut of subject matter, from landscaping to, you know, decrepit industrial decline images and everything in between.
And, you know, I imagine as you were going and into the painstaking effort of putting all of these images together, did you uncover any insights into yourself? I mean, as the person who captured these images, did you have any aha moments into your own you know, soul as you were reflecting on all these images and putting it together?
I think that a couple of things I would say is, one, as I look back on it now, it's a forcing function on getting me out there into places that I would not have normally gone. And, you know, particularly when you think about some of the industrial places, the rest of it, I'm not going to, you know, it's not a normal place you hang out and you say, hey, let's go to the, you know, the docks in old Baltimore or something for an afternoon. It's not like you're not normally going to say that. But I reflected on that. And I look at all those images and I think each one of them in their different way, it got me out to a place probably of which I wouldn't have gone to. And often I go out and, you know, try and plan these images and think about something that I'd take. And I go out there and I come back with nothing. You know, there was nothing that particularly, but you know what? It was a great day or a great morning, or, you know, I got up early at 4 o'clock and I'm back at like 11 or something. It got me out there and I experienced, you know, a wonderful sunrise or great nature, or, you know, discovered something that I didn't know and stimulating. So it's really a forcing function on getting you out there and experiencing stuff. So, you know, I think about all those images and bring back, you know, other thoughts and memories as I reflect on them. Because very often you're on your own. Very often you're in the middle of freaking nowhere, or, you know, there's hardly anybody around. I try not to go to, particularly on the landscape world, you know, there's a well-trodden path now of Instagram places that have been discovered. And you go there and there's like 500 photographers there at 4 in the morning waiting for this sunrise or whatever. And if I do that, I kind of walk away and go do something else, you know, because I think the world doesn't need any more sunrise or sunset images of some of these places. So I deliberately sort of go off to places that are, you know, the road less traveled, or everyone would like to say it. And a lot of the image that, you know, have actually become the most popular are not images of places that are particularly, you know, well known. And that's sort of the fun in it, because you're out there discovering, you know. And very often I will end up, the image that I end up developing and keeping is not the image that I really set my sights on or planned for that day. Very often it's not. It's a discovery, you know. it's a discovery as I've gone off somewhere else.
Interesting. Yeah, we'll go back to improv. It's an improvisation.
Yeah.
You know, it's something that you didn't necessarily plan on, but that you kind of discovered and came across. And I have to imagine that's where a lot of the fun comes from, is not knowing necessarily what's going to be the one.
And it's, you know, you can invest a lot of time and effort to get out to places, and you come back and the weather's not cooperating with you. And by the way, the perversity around that is, you know, in my particular style of photography, the worst thing in the world is sunlight. You know, a bright, clear day where people think that's a great, yeah, that's not, I like clouds, moody stuff and the rest of it. So a bad day for me is when the sun's shining or something, you know, there's no clouds in the sky, so it's a little perverse. But, you know, I'll come back without any images because just nothing really clicked or the weather was just not cooperating the rest of it. But you got to be philosophical about that. You spent some great time out in, you know, typically beautiful areas. And that's a good thing. It's a good for the soul.
Good for the soul. That's a great phrase to end on here, Gary. We talked about where people could buy the book. Where could people learn more about you if they're so inclined?
I have a website, gbsmith.com. Most of my work is on there in various collections.
All right. Be sure to put a link to the website in our show notes. So for anyone listening, they could just go right to the show notes and tap on them and tap on your link to your website. Also, we'll put links to the book as well. Gary, this has been fun. Thank you so much for stopping by Uncorking a Story and letting me uncork yours.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it. Thank you, Michael.
Thanks for listening to Uncorking a Story. If you'd like more information about today's guest or to find out more about Mike, go to uncorkingastory.com. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe, rate, and review us at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Tune in every week to hear Mike Carlin uncork a new story.